My name is Ed Chavez. I'm the marketing director and licensing director for Vertical Inc. I occasionally translate works.
Yay!
I do quite a bit of editorial for the company as well. And started up working in the industry, actually doing adaptations way back in the late 90s. So done a bit of everything when it comes to localization.
I'm Lillian Diaz-Prisbel. I worked for almost 7 years at Tokyopop as an editor, starting junior editor, worked my way up to senior editor. When Tokyopop collapsed, I've been doing sort of exciting freelance since then in various capacities, and I have my own little publishing company now. But I still do... Yay! Wow. Thanks. There's only one series that I actually translate. I have one Boys Love series for Viz that I work on. Which I can tell you if you're curious. But I fixed a lot of translations over the years. I was a Japanese and English double major when I was in college, so like, I was the first person on the Tokyopop staff, like actual staff, who could read Japanese. There were a couple of people who could sort of read it when I started in 2004.
Which means they couldn't.
I mean, they could figure out what something was wrong. They couldn't always figure out how to fix it. And the copy editor, we had a couple of copy editors who could speak and read Japanese, but I was the first staff member who could do that. And there were definitely a couple of things where I would get in a script and kind of retranslate it myself. That's my background.
I'm Nathan Collins. I'm a freelance translator. I've done work in video games, probably the most well-known is Rune Factory 2, and a bunch of cell phone games that probably nobody's heard of. I've done novels. Most recently, I did a new translation of Battle Royale for Haikusoru. And I've also done a novelization of Metal Gear Solid 4 and MM9 and various kind of thriller, horror, sci-fi kind of things.
I have a random question. How many people recognize why Haikusoru is called Haikusoru?
That's a good
Anybody?
Question.
Like, no.
Oh, man.
Yeah. It's I assume, because there's a Philip K. Dick book called Man in the High Castle, and High Castle, you say it Haikusoru in Japanese. And the part of the plot of the book is heavily involving Japan. Anyway, yeah.
I think that's been my best guess, so.
But yeah, like, but nobody gets the reference.
Yeah.
Like, it's a great name, but like,
it's
why?
A great name,
but... Why did they? Sorry. I really like that novel, too. That's part of why. Like, I'm disappointed that more people don't recognize it. Anyway.
My name is Stephen Hall, and I am a freelance translator. I've been doing mostly manga for, I'd say professionally, for close to a decade. I recently branched out into novels as well. I translate the One Piece manga for Shonen Jump. I also do some other things. I do the Sword Art Online manga and novels, for Kodansha. I also work for Kodansha, and I've done one of the prequel series for Attack on Titan, and also the Viking manga, Vinland Saga, among many other ones.
In the past, this has always been an extremely interactive panel, i.e., we really just start off by taking our cues from the other. Most of us being editors and translators, so interaction and teamwork is what we're all about. So what we usually do is just take questions from the audience, answer them from there, see how it goes.
I've actually got a question.
Unless anybody has something they want to start with.
I've got a question for sort of the other panelists. This was going to be, I'm sad that Bill Flanagan isn't here, because he's the one who might have actually been able to answer this. But I'm going to throw it out and see if anybody else has any ideas.
Yeah, we can just ask each other questions.
Yeah. So one of the things I've been working on lately is Viz is re-releasing Ranma 1/2. And I'm doing some script work on that. It's basically, they're keeping the original translations for that, which were done back in like the late 80s. And I'm sort of doing like a polish on it and double checking a lot of stuff. And one of the things, so I came into sort of anime and manga fandom in the mid 90s, thanks to Sailor Moon, like many people of my generation. And one of the first sort of like little terms that you learn as part of the fandom was glomp. And I was like, where did the word glomp come from?
Well, we had this conversation before.
Yeah, I asked you this at AX.
Yeah.
And I like, where did this, is it like an onomatopoeia? Why did this term come up? And in one of the early volumes of manga, which of Ranma, which was translated by Matt Zorn, among other people, they used glomp as one of the sound effects in there. So I'm like, is it possible that Matt Zorn, back in 1989, coined the term glomp for the entire English fandom? And I wanted to know if anybody else had any sort of historical perspective on that.
No, really, like, Bill, I think... Was it Viz around that time? Or might have been, like, around... I mean, yeah, he definitely was around when Rama was still being produced at some point.
Rama ran for a long time, though. That's the thing about Rama.
So...
Okay.
I certainly can't think of anything earlier.
Yeah. So that's your translation anecdote, is it's possible that Matt Thorne coined the term glomp. So...
Huh. I don't think Matt Thorne was ever a punk.
How many people?
He's got, like, some piercing.
Not one.
How many people are trying to look this up on their cell phone right now? Anybody? All right, if you find out, let us know.
Carl Horn will save us.
Well, now that I know we're allowed to do these Skype things, we should have, like, Carl on Skype when we show up. Okay, so I was talking about one thing. So, question.
I was wondering, what's the hardest part of translating a manga from Japanese to English?
All of it. Okay.
Wow.
Who wants to start with each one?
So this is because Tokyo Pop, the policy was generally not to translate sound effects or, like, to do that very minimally. The majority of my professional experience has not been dealing with sound effects. And then since leaving Tokyo Pop and freelancing for different places, I've had to start translating sound effects and, like, or at least thinking about that in a different way. And so for me personally, that was a much bigger challenge than I'd expected it to be. Like, for one thing, Japanese has a crap ton of onomatopoeia. Yes. So much that there's two different terms for it in Japanese to refer to sort of different types of sound effects. And a lot of them just don't have English equivalents.
Sound effects that aren't sounds. Mm-hmm.
There's sound effects, like, there's the sound effect for reaching out for something, which doesn't actually make a noise. It's like,
there's
how
sound
do you...
effect for a warm, fuzzy feeling when you're in love.
Yeah. Or for your heart kind of, you know, either skipping a beat or, like, the twinge that you get when you see the person that you like, all sorts of stuff like that. And it's both really fun to try and come up with stuff like that and really annoying sometimes.
That's definitely the most time-consuming part, I'd say.
Yeah.
Because at least, especially for Viz, they like to have the... They want you to just transliterate so they can get what the sound effect kind of was. And then you're supposed to tell, you know, give them kind of a rough definition. And then you're supposed to give a suggestion for what you think they should write. And all of those are kind of... You know, you're having to try to look up what it means, and then now you got to figure out yourself, and then you have to describe it.
Like, I'm not even sure what this sound represents. Mm-hmm. Like.
Yeah. I think one of the difficult things is actually kind of dependent on the editorial policy of the particular publisher, as far as you know, do they allow you to write notes? If you come across something that is very kind of inherently Japanese and is hard to put into English, you know, sometimes it can be easier if it's a company like Viz, where they generally issue notes in the back of the book or margin notes in the page. They kind of want it to speak for itself, and sometimes that gives you liberty to rearrange it into something that's a little easier to understand in English. And sometimes it's they kind of want you to leave it as close to the Japanese as possible. Some of the other publishers, and they prefer you to put notes in the back, and then that kind of raises this difficulty where you're kind of second guessing yourself, wondering, is anyone who is reading this, you know, the stuff that is actually on the page going to understand any of this, or, you know, is their understanding going to be based upon having to flip to the back of the book and look in your little glossary or your notes section just in order to tell what's going on? So sometimes you kind of have to make these somewhat editorial decisions on your own as a translator to try to gauge how much is the reader going to understand of what I'm, you know, translating on the page here.
All right, audience participation time.
I actually have another, like, really hard thing.
Notes in the back of the book.
Oh.
More than I expected. Then.
Well, I think that people who show up for a manga and translation.
Yeah, that's true.
audience.
Self-selecting. Yeah. I, for one, think a comic book or a manga should feel like you're watching a movie. And anything that takes away from that experience, like a note, you know, mm-hmm. oh, by the way, here's a little explanation, makes you kind of stop. And, oh, I'm reminded that this is just, I'm not, it kind of pulls you out of the story, which is why I generally don't like notes. I also don't like them as an editor because that's more work for us. That's the reason I hate it. That's the work. But it, notes in the back is fine, but then I always wonder, does anybody really actually? So you guys are saying you actually go to the back of the book and read the notes? Our work was not in vain. Okay.
So I have another thing that I think is really hard, which is puns are difficult in general. And the puns are worst when there's an image that it's referring to as well. There was a page in one of the volumes of Sayuki where it was like a joke about a table. And like I could manage to make a pun out of it, but then I had to try and tie it back to the fact that there was a picture of a table there. And I was like, oh, my God.
Just comedy in general tends to be pretty tricky. And I think, you know, outside of puns, just being really malleable as a writer is tough. Mm-hmm. You know, I do a lot of editorial, and you know, the translation that I do tends to be either for little kids or things that are 18 up. So there's a wide range of genre that's in the in between, and it's being able to fit into that mold for each style, for each genre, is not always easy. And you know, when you're a translator, you're often freelancer, so you're just kind of taking in whatever job that you can a lot of the time. I mean, I'm not sure some of the talent might be able to turn things down, but in most cases, you know, a lot of translators just take whatever they can get.
And you might not necessarily be getting that much guidance from
exactly.
the people. They might just expect you to do something, but not necessarily tell you what they're, you know, so well, there's a lot of times we translators are like kind of fishing around in the dark, is this what the editor wants? Yeah. I think all of us would agree that something... First, nobody cares who the translator is. You know, you care if it's Rumiko Takahashi. You care if it's some other famous manga. Nobody ever goes to the... Oh, wow, man. Stephen Paul translated this. I'm going to go get that. But you're not the consumer. You're
That's
Paul.
Right, yeah.
You're the editor. So, but we have to make every single day, you know, 1,000 decisions that will make a big difference in the final product. Decisions that the reader probably never even sees.
Yeah, in many cases we want to make that transition, like that reading process also smooth as possible, to the point where you don't have to think about the translator.
Yes.
Like you don't want to see mistakes, you know, you don't want to have gags that fall flat, you know, or visual puns that might not make sense anymore.
Or a translation that takes you out of the moment where you have to be like, wait,
that's
what is this supposed to mean? I really agree with that.
Most old school people remember like the really old dubs that were very clunky. Now I think if you want to study the history of fandom, the early fans actually kind of got off on that. They're like, they felt like I'm watching something that Americans can't watch. And look at these clunky translations. Aren't they almost cute? But in the end, what the fans want now is something, it's, you know, and what the market wants now is something that's smooth. It's got to be good. In fact, I think the better English is more important than a 100% accurate translation. It's more important to me now sometimes to have a good script writer than it is to necessarily have a good translator. It has to be both.
Yeah, ideally you want both, obviously.
But I've seen translations, heck, I've even done translations that were technically great, but it was just kind of clunky English. It took me a while to get used to, okay, I've got to remind myself, because I started off as a business translator. 100% accuracy was what it's all about. And you realize, as once you get into this, is no, it's not about keeping it accurate. It's about bringing the original artist's feeling to life. Like a pun, you don't want to translate the pun. Translated puns make no sense. You need to sometimes come up with a completely new joke that fits the art. What do you guys think about this? And then we have some more questions.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of complicated, actually. Like, it's one of my really, like, biggest frustrations with scanlations is for all of the really great translators that have come out of being scanlators, and for all of the people who work really hard on making good scanlations, there's a lot of crap that goes up there. And then that sort of becomes like the defining version for series that then come out later, and people are like, oh, it's less authentic because it doesn't read like crap. And you're like, no, it's because we had a translator who actually knew what they were doing and like had the time and had a copy editor to like make it look good. Like,
it drives me more crazy than have some fan saying, you translated it wrong. I'm like, how do you know?
I mean, some people do, but most people don't.
My friend has a cousin who has a girlfriend who took a semester of Japanese, and she told me that this word means something else. I'm like, okay.
I remember working on a title that had whole chapters that were just Buddhist Sutra. And fans came around saying, you know, this stuff is wrong. And I'm like, hold on a second. Can you... Do you understand Sanskrit?
First of all.
And then two...
Japanese translations of Chinese translations of Sanskrit. Yeah. Can you read that?
Yeah. And second of all, like some of these sutras, they have established translations. So I was just kind of playing around with them a little
bit. That's public domains. It's all good.
And making them work within the context of this comic.
Fit the balloon.
Yeah. Well, that and making sure that things kind of rhymed in weird good old ways. And yet I was being given a hard time, which is bizarre because...
It can be frustrating.
Yeah.
I think it's particularly difficult to find good feedback on your work as a translator because... almost inherently, the opinions that you'll read, like, you know, if you actually are foolhardy enough to go and try to look up reviews of things you translated, is that almost every time, if they point out things that they think are wrong, it's based on certain somewhat objective criteria, like this character's name is spelled differently from the, another version, the anime or the scanlation or what have you. But it's almost impossible for them, without knowing Japanese, to actually judge the character of the work itself. In other words, how well are you representing, the character's personalities? Is the stuff that is supposed to be poetic actually poetic? Is the stuff that's supposed to be crude, crude enough? All these finer details, and they're just much more subjective in reading, and so it's very, often cases, it sort of feels like, when you're looking up reviews of your own work, that any opinion that you see, it's sort of like looking up reviews of like convenience stores on Yelp or department stores, because the only people who are going to submit a review about that are the ones who are angry.
Yeah.
And you could have 100 people read your book, and you'll get 5 reviews, and it's the 5 people that had a bone to pick with it, and the other 95 were perfectly happy and they didn't think anything was wrong with it.
Or, because translators are such an invisible part of the process, and because sort of the ideal translation is something that's smooth and flowing, like, you don't want people to be thinking about it. You don't want them to be commenting on it, because that means that, like, something about it has... pinged them in a way, jarred them out of the experience. So,
a lot of times,
I really agree with that.
A lot of times, as the translator, you're kind of the last person in the chain who's really aware of the whole scope. I mean, there's always people who can, who know Japanese and English are reading both, and they can go through those comments. But a lot of times, you're working, with an editor who doesn't know Japanese, so you're kind of like the last line of defense on the side of trying to respect what was originally there, and you're the last person who really can understand who the what the mood is supposed to be and what the tone is supposed to be, and you're always trying to walk that balancing act of trying to make sure the English is readable enough and good enough to satisfy first your editor, and then more importantly the readers.
And then there's that whole can of worms that the Japanese original editors who don't read English, who then send us approval saying, "Oh, we don't like how you did this." I'm like,
that's another
thing. I don't know why. Like, Tokyopop didn't have to deal with that. I don't know what it was about the way we set up our licensing deals, but like,
how many times I've been to Edge, you probably have that.
There was probably only one or two series where we had anybody.
Sometimes Japanese, originally in the old days, they didn't care. We were just a paycheck back in the really early days. But as manga turned into a bigger thing in America and boomed, all of a sudden the Japanese said, "Oh, revenue." And I started paying attention.
Yeah, great point with that, too, because so we've been releasing Mobile Suit Gundam The Origin for like a year and a half now. And for the first four volumes or so, no issues. You know, we used their naming conventions that they had established and the like. But after, like, we'd gone to like four printings of volume one within like a year, then all of a sudden they wanted to check everything and they wanted to like nitpick.
Yeah, and all of a sudden you get like this 10-page fax saying, here's all the things we want you to do differently. And you're asking, who in your audience? And of course, Ed and I can tell you, how did they know something was wrong? Okay, they're in the audience. They've gotten the English version. Does the original Japanese artist read English? Does the original Japanese editor read English? No. Okay, who here in the company can read some English? The little intern in the back goes, well, I studied English for, 2 years. Okay, you're going to sit there and read the whole thing, and you're going to do the approvals. And they can't just say, oh, great job, because that means, oh, you didn't do anything. They have to say something. You've got to comment on this. This gentleman works with Dark Horse, so he can give you a whole
lot. I don't want to be conservative to what Mr. Paul said. There's someone in Japan and their particular duty is to look over the translations. Yeah. And they'll have a long list of things that they think are incorrect. And if they just go through it and say this is perfect, then they're not really doing their job. So they have to submit something.
Yeah, they have to say something.
Change this to is instead of whatever. Yeah. But then you have those fans that say that's incorrect and you can't accept the licensor told me to do it. Our translation was great. Yep. They ruined it.
This is a whole ball of wax. We have corrections coming from the Japanese side that we have to do things a certain way. My favorite example right now is there's a new anime which I had not, started getting after it. Attack on Titan. Oh, this is a place called Titan that is going to get attacked. And then you finally get to see the series, like, it was supposed to be Attack of the Titans. And so the first question, why did you call it Attack on Titan? Because the original Japanese creator had an English subtitle calling it Attack on Titan, which now that it's out, we can't change it. But that's exactly the kind of example. There were so many times when the Japanese side would, or even inside of a manga, there'd be an American character who shows up. Even if something's not released in America, American character shows up, and they've got the dialogue in English. And it's like, absurd. I'm like, dude, I'm three desks away from you. You could have asked me. It's it's like five panels, but it just makes absolutely, like, why didn't you? Oh, well, I just wrote what I thought was good. And fine, but sometimes we have like a sign or a t-shirt or a design inside our version that now has really bad English on it. And we like, do we change it? Do we leave it the way it is? Yeah. Let's get some more questions from the audience. There was a lady, somebody in the background.
Very carefully.
Yeah. With much difficulty.
Working as a freelance translator, is it relatively manageable to find work, or are you really living from paycheck to paycheck while trying to find something?
What's that? Hit that bad cock.
I don't know if I'm the best person to answer this because it's about building a relationship with your editors who give you work. Because, you might get your foot in the door and they say, okay, we're going to put you on this title. And that's going to be one book every 3 months at the soonest. And that, obviously that's not going to work by itself. So you have to kind of prove yourself and, meet your deadlines and turn in good work and all that. And then they start to give you more. And then you take it to other companies and so on. And at some point, you can get it to the point where you're basically working full time and you can support yourself. And until I reached that point, I had been living at home, so I had kind of a little subsidization going on to make sure that I could support myself before I was paying all the bills for myself. But I think it takes a lot of time, and you really have to prove yourself to get enough work. But I mean, personally, right now, I'm so busy, I'm starting to have to turn away work. So, there's a lot out there.
Definitely, particularly starting out, you can definitely run into the kind of like feast or famine situation where, I've had 4 months where there was just nothing, and then all of a sudden had two or three jobs come in that all want to be 4, 5, 6 months, and then you have to go like, well, I wish one of those came in earlier, and then you have to make a hard decision about what to do.
And You don't know. In freelancing anything, you never want to say no.
Mm-hmm.
Freelance web design, never say no.
I'm doing a good amount of work for Crunchyroll for their manga division at the moment, which is a lot of fun, and they're really fun to work with. That's actually one of the few things that has been relatively steady, because they're doing a lot of like simultaneous publication of chapters. So like, I know that like the third week of the month, I'm going to get a couple of chapters that I need to work on. But I was told when I signed up for that job, particularly because it's digital only, they were like, don't quit your day job, because the money's just not there. And this is true. Like, it's good. It's a good supplement. It's good pocket money. But it's, I like would never want to try and raise a family on what I'm making from Crunchyroll. So.
Oh, that's got a real job.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I work full time. But as an editor, I end up working with a stable of translators and don't necessarily deviate from it too much, unless you've been an intern in the company and you get to see what our turnaround time and what our production values are. So, we're pretty committed to the people who we work with, though. So, in the case of like the person who's working on the Attack on Titan novel, he's working on two other titles for us right now. He's getting paid quite well, I think, for his time and effort. And we also do things in-house, too. So we're a little different from some of the larger publishers in that regard, but I can definitely attest to the fact that particularly when we're assigning new translators to new series, you could go for months, maybe even a year or two without getting a new assignment. So,
I think there's only one time that I've hired a brand new translator, and I'm trying to remember how I ended up hiring her. How she kind of came across.
Recommendation, probably. Was it a recommendation?
No, she'd never done anything before.
No,
she was like completely brand new. So she had the right background for it. So like she had sort of a resume that made me think that this was a good situation. I might have just like met her at a con or something and just had a conversation with her. And she's like, "Can I send you a translation sample?"
Yeah, I've never actually taken.
And it ended up working out really well, but that's the only time I've ever done that. Yeah.
I can say something that I think Ed would back me up on. I've been an repetitive, where I've got to put out a whole bunch of things at once, and I'm not doing the individual translation. And frankly, I am better off if I've got 10 people working on one title each than if I have one brilliant guy working on all 10 titles. It is not in my best interest to have some. On the one hand, we want to keep our people fed. On the other hand, it's easier for me if I've just got 10 different people who are just doing one thing each. Then if one of them gets sick, the problem if you have like one guy who has four titles, he gets appendicitis. All of a sudden you've got four volumes that is not on time. Yes, you can find somebody to fill in, but I think Ed knows what I mean here. It's in our best interest to have...
Yeah, definitely. I mean...
A bunch of part-timers than it is to have three full-timers.
Yeah, I mean, as I said before, we've got a stable of people that we work with, so...
That's what you want to build up. You can build up a stable, but...
Yeah, and, thankfully, they all know what our style is and what our schedules are like. And, we do introduce new people as, people level up and, go to work for Penguin or Random House and the like. But, it is important because you also want to be able to, introduce new talent.
Yeah.
And to see what other people are providing in the market itself, in the business market. You don't want to just be stuck with the same voices doing everything. Which,
so. And despite your best efforts, most translators will kind of tend to have a certain style. And if you have one translator doing everything you put out is going to have the same stuff.
Yeah, same thing.
As opposed to the manga itself, where it's all being done by different people, and that's why it's great, because every one of them is so completely different.
Yeah, and same thing with editors, too. I mean,
editors, too, yeah.
They might have the same tone throughout.
Style's actually something that's really difficult to convey, speaking of stuff that's like... And it's just a linguistic difference between English and Japanese, where you can convey a lot of character through grammar choices and sort of how people are talking to one another, whereas you don't have those sort of options in English. And so the best way to do it is to sort of substitute vocabulary. And so you can tell the translators and people who do English adaptations who read a lot and have a big vocabulary, because they'll make word choices that are just more interesting and kind of convey more than somebody who's just sticking with like the dictionary definition of something. So, and it's not that either of those are like right or wrong per se. It's not a sort of a correctness issue. It's just it's a flexibility issue. Like, English is a very flexible language in that way. So I like translators who really take advantage of that.
I hate those people. There's one of the things that's happened in the industry. Some publishers, not all, not Kodansha would never do this, but you had a lot of scanlators show up in the business who would then were willing to work for nothing. There was a certain publisher who shall remain nameless that was notorious for paying just nothing and putting out manga, and then that becomes the market price. And I myself have turned down work many times, saying, it is not worth my time to work for as little as you are offering. I don't know if anybody else has had that experience, but
I think it's a time versus money.
So yes, you're right. I was wrong. I don't say take everything.
Like I was saying, Crunchyroll pays very, very little, but it tends to be very straightforward work, and because I'm going chapter by chapter, like it just doesn't take very long. And so, like, the time versus money equation for that, for me at the moment, makes sense. Do I have concerns about how that affects industry rates? Absolutely. I think that's a real... But it's also, like, having been at Tokyopop for a long time as well, like, I understand the business side of it. And until digital establishes itself as a market that actually is profitable, I'm just not sure what other options these companies have to some extent. We'll see what happens over the next year or two, because I think things are going to really change pretty dramatically in that regard. And sort of the experiences of J-Manga and its rapid demise, I think, was a good example of how quality versus quantity is something you need to work on very carefully, particularly when it comes to digital, and that's both content-wise and translation-wise. Like, I did some work for them at the time as well. And I like the teams I was working with there, but I know that some of their outsourced stuff I thought was coming from, I don't know, Singapore or somewhere, and the quality was just all over the map, and that's a problem. So you're going to have a really hard time establishing kind of a digital space as legitimate and as professional when you're not paying professional rates.
She mentioned something very important, and that's the economics of the situation. Whenever you pay, let's just arbitrarily say $10 for a volume of manga, just so it's a nice round number, the vast majority of that money goes to the Japanese publisher.
Not the translation.
a relatively thin margin of that goes to everybody on the American side, including the American publisher, the American, you got to pay an editor, you got to pay a translator, you got to pay a reletter, you got to pay all these people. And they're all cutting
marketing,
up a relatively
sales, distribution.
Thin slice of the pie.
Yeah.
You know, it's when the American comics or manga in Japan, the original artist is making the art. But here, we're having to pay a license fee to somebody else, and then with what's left over, pay everybody. That's one of the reasons both Marvel and DC have never done very well licensing, because their attitude is, we create content, we don't license it from somebody else. Why should we be, paying a licensing fee? You have to have companies that are willing to understand this business and work with that, and you have to have people that are willing to appreciate the economics. What do you guys think about that?
Well, I think from the standpoint of a translator, someone who does this stuff, I think that possibly, particularly as you run into issues with, as Lillian was saying, the sort of the economics of quality, that if you are good enough, you can probably kind of negotiate a little bit with, you know, you can make a name for yourself as being, hey, this is a person who does really good work. This is who we should go to when we actually do have this big title that's coming out that needs to be done well, because this is our chance to, you know, to kind of make a splash. If it's, particularly if it's from a source that, you know, is not widely established, like a Viz or a, you know, Yen Press or something like that. And some of the publishers that I have worked with, you know, they give you kind of an entry rate, and then once they like you and they decide, oh, we can, you know, we want to keep this person around, and, you know, they want to continue doing this line of work, then, you know, you have a little bit of room to hope for a little bit of a raise, something that is, you know, helps support you full time better than, you know, the startup money that you make.
And there are definitely still companies and editors who recognize and value quality, and if you can prove yourselves to them, that's definitely going to be a big help. And I kind of getting back to the you know, in terms of, you know, deciding to accept something or not, you know, based on the rate. For me, I know that varies. There's so many factors in there. It's like, you know, how long is the project? Is this something I could just do for a couple days and I don't have anything going on? And sure, is it a title that's interesting? Is this a company that can lead to more work in the future? I mean, there's all kinds of, I'm sure we could probably come up with 10 or 20 different things that would change whether or not we feel it's a good rate. But I have to say, like, as a freelancer, my least favorite question to get is, what is your rate?
Yeah.
You go like...
Yeah.
I had to answer that the other day. Yeah. I was like...
Is somebody else bidding less? And if I bid too high, am I going to lose? One of the worst things that happened to me recently was somebody gave me a project. I should have paid a little more attention. Somebody gave me a project. They showed me something. They said, how much would you charge for that? And it was, I should have waited until the next morning. A little sequence. Oh, I can do this for $150. And this person, that's all? Oh, I thought it was going to be like $1,000. I'm like, crap. Did I say 100? And that'll happen to you too, right? You bid too low and you end up working for nothing. You bid too high and they go with somebody else. And we don't have other people telling us, here's what you should bid. If business translators have a whole different pay scale. So.
But if you start high, you can always come down. But if you're too low, you can't go
If you start high, they say, oh, thank you very much. We'll talk to you later. And if you bid too low, they say, great. And then you can't necessarily go back and say, at least not with that one job. So.
There's a lot of things where it's like I get an email and I'm like, I'm going to answer this tomorrow. I'm just going to sleep on this.
So, yeah, I'm
like, I know that you want an answer urgently, but I need
morning.
To kind of process.
Bad idea.
So.
Yeah, one thing that I get as digital is becoming more of an option is some of my translators are now getting hired by like Crunchyroll and other establishments to work for them, and I'm not sure if it's just, you know, people's perception of what vertical quality is, but under most circumstances, when our talent ends up going to work for places like CR, they pretty much get the rate that we charge, which is a starting rate of about $10 a page. So that's pretty dang good.
There's lots of companies that are offering
for manga. And pretty good if you're talking about a digital translation. But in certain cases, quality surpasses many things, particularly when you're dealing with titles like Attack on Titan. And with Ajin and Flowers of Evil and things like that. So things that have some cachet, companies might be willing to
show out a little more for. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mr. Collins has a question here.
It's an observation, but I'd like to hear you talk about it. And that is, you mentioned this concept that the translator is kind of considered invisible and unimportant. But it seems to me with a novel, where you are,
it's all
writing
words.
New novel based on this other novel, that it's a real missed opportunity not building names for the translators, not putting their names bigger on the cover.
Yeah, we at Vertical. Kind of thing. Yeah, at Vertical we put all of our translators for novels on the cover. They're also part of the copyright for the books, which means that they get royalties on top of that. That is in a contract, though, so after X amount of units sold, there will be royalties. In our case,
it's at... Talk to this man. Well,
they're very different worlds.
Yeah, very different worlds.
And as Nathan should know very well, translated prose is... manga is niche. Translated prose is another world entirely smaller.
And you can't cheat. You have no visual clues to fall back on.
Yeah, forget about that, too. I mean, it just, when we talk about markets... it's hard to sell those books unless you have names, you know, like Metal Gear, you know, or Battle Royale. And
that goes back to the whole thin slice of pie market.
So, you know, my company is based... Everybody in my company is a translator, even the letterers, and outside of our designers. So we've gone through this grind before. That's why we don't skimp on our translation fees. That's also why we're very critical when it comes to our editorial. It takes us months, maybe more time than the translator takes to translate for us to edit. Because I'm not going to say we're correcting everything, but we're rewriting. Yeah, because not every translator is a good writer. So, something that we're very, very cognizant about, but it's also something that we are given economic pressure that is very different, particularly when it comes to prose. Yeah, with manga, you know, we can kind of fudge a little bit with media tie-ins. Not everyone's going to know, you know, the most recent sexual identity novel that just came out of Japan that we translated. Really good, but you know, it might sell 100 copies.
We're beginning to run short on time, so let's get some more questions. Yes.
In terms of when you're localizing and you're confronted with something that's, you know, well, this is a very Japanese specific thing, you know, making the choice to change it into American thing, like Phoenix Wright is an example that popped into my head. You know, one of the characters likes a particular thing of food in an American translation. It's like this American food that when you look at the context of what's going on, it's sort of awkward that she's, you know, in a kimono and she's like, oh, I like hamburgers. And you're like, who made that choice? Why do things like that happen? And like, in terms of...
I'm not sure that anybody makes that choice anymore. I think that that's something that happens very early in the industry, particularly when there's a sense that maybe if we kind of make things more American, then it'll sort of expand the market somehow.
Pokemon, they so Americanized it at first, which we don't really have to do that anymore, don't you think? Not so much?
Less. I think Dorado. A lot less. There's certain things that, like... I think a lot about the audience, who's going to be reading it, in terms of how sort of Japanese specific I will make a particular translation. So like, not everybody's going to know what anpan is. So like, it probably makes more sense most of the time for me to translate that as like bean buns or bean bread or whatever. But there was something I was working on where someone was referred to as a tsundere, which if you're a nerd and you speak Japanese, you know sort of the implications of that word. And I'm like, I think most of the people who are reading this particular series are going to know what a tsundere is, and they'll get the joke that's implied in that. Whereas for a different series, I probably would have tried to come up with an English term for that. I really avoid using Japanese terms as much as possible. Like, there's times when it does make sense, but I think it's almost always avoidable.
I used to do it too much because when I got into this, I was still living in Japan, and I thought, oh, sure, everybody knows what this is. And I realized, no, you really do. In the end, a translation is not the original thing.
But yeah, like, you know, changing yakiniku to hot dogs, like, that's dumb. Yeah. Why would you do that? But calling yakiniku barbecue, like, I think that there's a lot of series where that's going to make more sense. And for your average reader, that's going to be an easier reading experience. It's going to keep you in the flow of it.
But it is possible for it to be too Japanese-y, and the audience just doesn't get it.
Yeah, so this came up, this is not even a series that I worked on, but there was a series that Tokyopop did called Tramps Like Us. That was their title. It's a great, great series, like just Jose romance. It's brilliant. I handed it to a friend of mine who'd read some comics, a girl. Loves Sex and the City, like that type of person. She really, really liked that series, but got completely confused by the fact that there were still Japanese suffixes in it. So she, you know, that's Hatsumi Senpai. She's like, what does that mean? And I was like, that's a problem, because that was a series that did not sell as well as it probably could have for Tokyopop, and like it just didn't. There's an audience that was clearly there and like interested in reading it, and there were barriers that we had left in that material that was preventing them from doing so.
Good point.
So. Anybody else? Like, sorry, I just like.
To add to that, I think a lot of it is accessibility to the internet as well. I know we redid Oh My God, it's the entire series, and one of the characters refers to a Japanese pop star who is Momomino, who probably no one knows about, but in the original we said Tiffany. Because at the time when it came out, now you can look it up and find out what kind of music she does and everything else. And even in Japanese, but in 1991, that wasn't a possibility. So I think that there are.
That's a really.
The audience was the American audience was way less sophisticated about Japanese stuff back then. I just saw recently an episode of Bones where they decided to do all this Japanese-y thing, you know, and a Japanese person got killed and the Japanese fiance had to come over. First, they hired nothing but Korean actors, so when they're talking Japanese, it sounded awful. They're making these cultural references that just like. No, you got that wrong. Then you got that. So there's still a lot of lack of sophistication in the audience. Obviously, manga reading audience is going to be more sophisticated. But I think we can definitely get away with more direct translation than we used to be able to, like, 20 years ago.
Yes.
And the nice thing about being a translator is if you're not sure whether or not to adapt it a little bit more, you can always just leave it closer to Japanese and just say, okay, now it's the editor's.
Make it somebody else's problem.
Can we get one more question? Okay. This gentleman here.
You had mentioned something about translating the suffixes at the end of names. What do you like to do when you have a situation like that? Do you only introduce the suffix that stands out? Like if someone's making an effort to call a character something different than what they were going to call.
Can I defer to somebody else in that question? Series by series, case by case. Like, I do not like using things like Oni-sama. Like, I think that starts getting way too over the top. And, like,
really
there's.
Interrupts the flow of the writing.
Yeah. Like, even though, like, I get that there's an implication for that. Like, I get why that's sort of significant to a portion of the audience, that means something to them. But I think far more often than not, that just ends up being confusing.
And on the other hand, Big Brother doesn't quite sound the same.
Bro.
But, I mean, that's one of the things. This is a good, like, translation difference, is that you don't refer to people by their names quite as much in Japanese, whereas you do in English. So, like, swapping that for just, say his freaking name.
Yeah.
Like, he's your Big Brother, just call him Joe or whatever.
that's definitely where your kind of, your handle on the English language and vocabulary and tone definitely becomes crucial. Because I do like to drop as much of that stuff as possible, because I do think it throws up barriers. But you got to find, like, something to replace it with.
A historical series I feel a little differently about, so like keeping.
I did Kazuhikaru, and that's was so much a period piece, and the original author was deliberately putting in a lot of Japanese medieval culture. And she even had the section in the back where here's the author's notes. She's actually saying, oh, here's all the research I did.
Yeah.
Then I felt like, okay, I've really got to keep this as Japanese-y. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
as
but
possible,
for like a science fiction fantasy series, like it doesn't make any sense for people to call each other San and Sama, probably.
Well, that might change. I mean, you know, audiences change. That's where it's really
That's
where it's really important to keep pace with the fandom and keep reading things and kind of understand, because, you know, 20 years ago people translated things, you know, Yakiniku was hot dogs.
Yeah.
And, you know, 20 years from now, maybe everybody's going to implicitly understand what, you know, san and san.
It'd be like Firefly and all that.
Right.
All the time
anyway.
And then it'll all make sense.
Nothing but English.
I was just wondering if our handlers were giving us the stop. STOP.
There it is.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all.